I'm Tom Hall. It's Friday, and it's midday. Today, it's midday at the museums. My guests are the directors of two of Baltimore's most acclaimed institutions. Rebecca Hofberger is the founder and director of the American Visionary Art Museum, which for nearly 25 years has exhibited the work of so-called outsider artists from all over the world. Marvin Pinkert is the executive director of the Jewish Museum of Maryland, founded 60 years ago to tell the story of Maryland's vibrant Jewish community. AVAM and the Jewish Museum currently both have exhibitions devoted to stories from the Holocaust that revolve around fabric and fashion. Plus, the great cabaret singer and pianist Steve Ross joins me in Studio A to talk about his show at Germano's Piattini tonight. Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us for Midday at the Museums today. Today we're going to take a look at two museums in Baltimore with current exhibits that put a spotlight on individuals who are linked by their love of working with fabric and the horrors of the Holocaust. Rebecca Hofberger is here. She's the founder, director, and principal curator of the Visionary Art Museum. AVAM is dedicated to intuitive, self-taught artistry. It's been a fixture on Key Highway and Federal Hill since 1995. Their exhibition, Esther and the Dream of One Loving Human Family, features the embroidery and fabric collages of Esther Kinnitz. Rebecca, good to see you.
It's wonderful to be with you.
Welcome back. And Marvin Pinkert is here as well. He's the executive director and CEO of the Jewish Museum of Maryland, a role that he assumed 7 years ago. It was founded in 1960 as the Jewish Historical Society of Maryland to preserve the Lloyd Street Synagogue, the third oldest synagogue still standing in the United States. Their current exhibition is called Stitching History from the Holocaust, which features fashion design by Heidi Strad, a Czech Jew who perished in the Holocaust. Marvin, welcome back to you as well, sir.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And listeners, if you have a question for Marvin Pickert or Rebecca Hofberger, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR, and we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Rebecca, let's just start with you. Tell us a little bit about Esther Kinnitz and the exhibition that you have around her work.
Well, this is a one-off that will be up for 5 years, and her name is Esther Kinnitz.
Kinnitz, excuse me.
And that's all right, and we were the very first to exhibit her work, and then it went to 42 different museums around the world, and the wonderful daughters, Bernice and Helene, wanted it to come back to us in a more permanent way. So I said, you know, let's use the power of Esther's 36 embroideries that talks about the happiness of being in a little farm community with a thatched roof and a dirt floor and cows and chickens in the middle of Poland, and how happy and pastoral that life was, and how good the relationships were with the Christian farming neighbors. They would help each other bring in, you know, the crops and the harvest. And then what happened? And then juxtapose it with other embroideries and works by people from Rwanda, who also had little thatched roofs with chickens and cows and happy life and jokes and favorite foods and their own holidays. And someone, somewhere, decides that they are an undesirable other. And so that this exhibition, Esther and the Dream of One Loving Human Family, looks at Native American genocide, the hate crimes that happened under apartheid, with our collection of embroideries from Rwanda, from South Africa, in addition to the Rwanda story, so that you see, you almost dissect or do an autopsy on how do innocents become victims, you know, throughout history, even to today when you think of the Rohingya and you think of, you know, what's happening in Yemen. And so it's really the most actually uplifting exhibition because it uses that stitched testimony to talk about a part of human history that unfortunately is and as enduring as ever.
And I'm sorry I haven't had a chance to run down and see it yet. It's been up since February, and as you mentioned, it'll be here for 5 years, which is great. So there's ample opportunity for all of us to see it. But describe Esther Krinitz's work. I mean, it's very intricate embroidery, and they almost look like paintings that are done with a needle and thread.
Yes, and you have to remember, Esther began this because her very first one was to show her family what her village and her house looked like. And it progressed just for her family, never to be in a museum or shown to someone else, you know. Esther was a seamstress. She did not consider herself an artist. But like many of the people in our museum, our National Museum, it's that intuitive power when you have something inside that there are no words for. It comes out as this amazing work. So she knew stitchery, and it's applique as well. It's not all stitched. And the complexity and her love for nature. When Esther makes a field, let's say even if it's a field of grass with flowers, the grass has 9 different silk threads, colors of green. And actually, the bees, her bees that she raised, saved her life and ran off 2 Nazis. So it's this dance that is, so poignant because it shows happy times to when the Nazis came in on horseback and beat up her grandfather and cut his beard. And it started off like hooliganism. These were very simple people. They had no idea it would lead very quickly to the final solution.
Mm. And of course, as you say, you use her work as a springboard, as a launching point to talk about genocide and other periods of history and in other places. Yeah. And Marvin Pinkert, speaking of stitchery, one of your exhibitions, you've got 2 going, but one of them, which I guess has come from a museum in Milwaukee, is that right? It's called Stitching History from the Holocaust. It's also about a person very concerned with, it is about a person concerned with fashion.
Right. And again, it's a story of one individual as opposed to, this was about, the Holocaust is about the death of 6 million individuals, not just the death of 6 million people. So it's a very unique story. It begins in someone's basement where they're cleaning out the basement and they discover a letter which is marked with the censor markings of the Nazi government. And they share it with the museum director in Milwaukee. And the document turns out to be a desperate plea from the cousins of this gentleman in Milwaukee, the Hedy and Paul Strenad, for their intervention in trying to get them into the United States because they can see what's coming. The Sudetenland has been taken over by the Nazis, and they're living in Prague, and they see the handwriting on the wall. Unfortunately, they do not make it out. They are sent first to Theresienstadt, and then from there, they're sent out to the Warsaw Ghetto, where it's believed that they died.
So they were writing to these relatives in Milwaukee saying, can you do anything to help us get out? Mm-hmm.
And the director of the Milwaukee Museum, which hadn't even been fully finished yet, became impressed with the story and decided it would be one of the first things she put on display. And she put it on display, and someone walked in and said, is this all you're going to do with this? And she said, well, what else could I do with it? And she said, what about creating the dresses that Hedy Strenad designed? What about illustrating that creativity? And as it happened, the Milwaukee Repertory Theater had recently put on a performance of The Diary of Anne Frank. And so they turned to the Milwaukee Rep and said, are you interested? And not only were they interested, but they went out and they actually recreated using fabrics, zippers, everything from the period where they couldn't find the precise pattern. They silk screened the cloth in order to make it identical to the drawings that Hedy Strenad had prepared. And so they've been sending around the country these 8 dresses that were unfortunately unable to save the lives of these 2 people.
So just to be clear, Hedy was writing to these folks in Milwaukee.
Actually, it was her husband, Paul, who was writing to folks in Milwaukee.
Saying, my wife is a fashion designer.
Right.
And here are some examples of
what her talent is.
Uh-huh. So she would be a very, she would be an employable, useful person to have.
And from the letter, in fact, they weren't even sure of her first name. So, but it turned out that they discovered as the years passed that she had a niece who had survived the war, had been on the last Kinder transport out of Germany. And they eventually found the niece and were able to determine that the niece had a letter from Hetty, the only document we know of that has her name on it. And they took the signature on the bottom of the document and they turned it into a label. And they so they put the label into all the clothing that they created has Hetty's name on it.
Isn't that great? Givenchy and Hetty.
Yeah. Right.
That's terrific. And as I understand it, Rebecca, both this, the exhibition at the Jewish Museum and at AVAM, were organized by, of all things, a theater company, the Chesapeake Shakespeare Theater Company, who are doing a performance of Diary of Anne Frank, which opens in a few weeks. And they put together, or they approached you and I guess some other folks about having, you know, related exhibitions at museums. So this is a real interesting...
It's a little bit different from that. We discovered mutually that we were all planning at the same time to do exhibitions and plays related to the Holocaust. And so the thought came out, starting with Chesapeake Shakespeare, which helped put us in the same room, that their production of Anne Frank, the Morgan State University's production of Anne and Emmett, which is about Anne Frank.
Which is an imaginary conversation between Anne Frank and Emmett Till.
Right.
And we're going to be talking to those folks in a couple of weeks.
The folks
too.
At the BMA who did Monsters and Myth.
The Surrealist exhibition.
The post World War I period. And then our two exhibitions. And we said, you know, this is something that is notable when five institutions in the same city decide that it's worth their effort to collaborate, and we decided we'd get together and cross-promote. And that's where the idea for Baltimore Spring of Remembrance came from.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of us are telling individual stories, but we're also telling a universal story that applies not just to the singular experience of the Holocaust, but to all the other forms of oppression and dehumanization that have taken place in the decades since.
Yeah, and Rebecca, it is so easy for all of us to, you know, use familiar rhetorical phrases like the 6 million, you know, in the Holocaust. But it's, as Marvin says, it's 6 million individual human beings, you know, in the city of Baltimore, you know, 70 deaths or whatever it is. Maybe it's a little bit more now in 2019, you know, and 300 in this year and 197 back in, you know, 1999 or something. And these facts and figures don't really get us emotionally involved in the horror of all of this.
Well, that's why the anniversary of the birth of Anne Frank, she would have been 90, is this summer. And that was synchronous as well. But I think the power of her diary was that it speaks as this enlightened, tender, so full of hope and kindness child. And, you know, it speaks to all people, just as Marvin was saying. And I'm so excited about the Morgan production of juxtaposing young Emmett Till. You know, this irrational hatred is something so important for us to discuss at this time. Martin Buber really colored my whole presentation of this show with his I thou versus I it. Terry Pratchard put it, evil begins when you begin to treat human beings as things, not as sacred others. And that can be sexual objects. I mean, it can be a lot of, you know, just making them an it, you know? And so we're
and
living...
And an other it
another
to boot.
It. Right, exactly.
Yeah, right.
And we live in a time where, you know, people are being called vermin by, you know, high office. So we really, it's a cry to say how dangerous whenever we objectify another person and forget that they are a human being just like us. And that's where the power of our show, which also goes back to the Native American genocide experience, which was also literally in the millions. And we have a survivor who went on to become the first American Catholic saint, Saint Kateri, who was a survival of our experiment in biological warfare. We knew that the Native Americans had no immunity to smallpox, so we would gift them, you know, blankets, and then wait 3 months for everybody to die and take over their land. So that story is told within the power of Esther's story alongside of what happened in Rwanda. You know, people have these little prejudices, you know, against people, but it's kind of like, it doesn't really go anywhere. But then when they're accused of something, how quickly demonizing people with these terrible names can be inflamed to catastrophic end. And that's exactly what happened in Rwanda with 100 days of 800,000 people, men, women, and children, grandparents, being slaughtered when they were wrongfully accused by the dominant culture, the Hutus, of being implicit in the plane crash of the Hutu president. We have to learn from these experiences.
And Marvin Pinker, do we have any background or any insight into why it was that Paul and Hedy Stranad were not able to come to the—
Yes.
—United States? What do we know about the rest of that story?
Well, this is a story that has some relevance to today. In 1920, 320,000 Czechs were able to emigrate to the United States. And that was a time of peace. In 1924, America decided there was no room, and they decided that there would be the Johnson-Reed Act. And that act then restricted immigration, so that in 1924, 3,000, not 320,000, were allowed to be admitted, and that was both Jewish and non-Jewish. And, you know, you look at that and you say, how many thousands might have been saved if we had been a little more understanding of the fact that surely at 105 million we had some, which was a population of the United States in 1920, we had at least a little room in America.
Yeah, now we're talking about running out of room again.
Right.
Certain people are talking about that, to be sure. We're going to take a little break and we'll come back and talk more about these two exhibitions. Marvin Pinkert is the executive director of the Jewish Museum of Maryland here in Baltimore. Rebecca Hofberger is the founder of the American Visionary Art Museum. Midday at the Museums continues after this quick break. You can join us at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can drop us a tweet at Midday WIPR. You can follow me on Twitter at Tom Hall WIPR. And you can also catch us on the WIPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Looking ahead to Monday on our program, microbiologist Michael Jacobson from the Center for Science in the Public Interest will join me to talk about food safety and nutrition. He'll be here Monday on Midday. And coming up a little bit later today, the cabaret legend Steve Ross will join me here in Studio A. He's playing tonight at Germano's Piattini in Little Italy, and we'll get a little preview of his set just a little bit later today. If you've just joined us, it's Midday at the Museums. My guests are Rebecca Hofberger, the founder and director of the American Visionary Art Museum. Their current show is called Esther and the Dream of One Loving Human Family. Marvin Pinkert is the executive director of the Jewish Museum of Maryland. The two shows that have just opened there are called Stitching History from the Holocaust, about a dressmaker lost in the Holocaust, and Fashion Statement, a show put together in conjunction with Stevenson University. You can join us if you have a question for Rebecca Hofberger or Marvin Pinkert. 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wipr.org. You can drop us a tweet at Midday WIPR, and you can catch us on the WIPR Facebook page because we're streaming our conversation. So Marvin Pinkert, this other complimentary exhibition that you have with Stitching Histories from the Holocaust called Fashion Statement. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Well, that exhibit is actually drawn from our own collection. We decided that when we were going to bring in the exhibit from Milwaukee, which was a smaller exhibit, we had room for a second show. And in this one, if one show talks about the way in which the threat was external to Jewish life, the other talks about how Jewish life has always been influenced by identity and the issues of retaining identity. And so clothing is treated as a language. And we look at the Yiddish accent.
Yeah, clothing as a language.
Yes.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Because it's a way of expressing ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, everybody has their own twists and turns in terms of the way that they present themselves to the world and do it in different ways on different occasions. And so we decided that this question of assimilation and identity as expressed through clothing was rather important because it is both about fitting in, but also about standing out. So we deal with questions of clothing as expression of status, clothing as an expression of membership. One of my favorite objects on loan to us is leather jacket of the Semites on bikes. I'll let you figure out what the initials are.
And Semites on bikes. There you go. It's like the synagogue in Alaska. They call themselves the Frozen Chosen. Yeah.
of course, the ubiquitous T-shirts that are for every purpose. We have one from my former deputy, Deborah Carden, that says, "Vote for my daddy," when she was 7 years old. A picture of her and the T-shirt itself. And then we have clothing that relates to religious practice, covering the head. And we have yarmulkes from the 1840s that were hand-painted. And we have one with Elmo on it from the early 2000s.
yeah. That's what, you know, because Rebecca, I don't know who I was talking to, an artist whose name, I just can't remember which artist, who said, you know, every morning when you get up and you get dressed, that's a creative act, you know, and because sometimes people put this notion of creativity as if it's off to the side. It's something that some people do. You know, you talk to people, oh, I'm an accountant or I'm a dentist or I'm a, you know, a maintenance worker. I'm not creative. The whole mission of the American Visionary Art Museum is to say, you know, the art academy isn't the only place where creativity and art comes from.
Absolutely. And in fact, so many accountants and things will say, oh, no, I'm not the creative one. My sister or my brother is. And then you'll look at the work of the brother, the sister. They're doing, like, I don't know, knockoffs of Holly Hobby, you know, and it's like nothing. You look, no. In what ways have you grabbed the reins of being creative in your own life? You know, how you use your voice as you make an art of you, how you used your voice, you know, how you garden. You know, it's not just things that can be hung on a wall or sit on a pedestal. And the healthiest ancient societies that were the most prolific in art making never had a word for art. They had something that was incumbent of value on all citizens, and that was to do everything so beautifully with great attention. So,
but no word, no language to describe what we've come to know as art.
No, they had words that meant well made or beautifully performed, but it wasn't that the artiste makes the art for the rest of us. Uh-uh. Mm-hmm. It was no separation.
Yeah, and Marvin Pinkert, the I don't want to say pressure, but the admonition perhaps for cultural institutions of all ilks, music organizations, dance organizations, literary organizations, and museums, to be engaged with the community. That's the sort of buzzword these days and has been for probably the last decade or so. It's really important to have engagement. What does that mean to you as the director of an historical museum that's telling a historical story as well as reflecting what's going on currently in this very vibrant Jewish community here in Maryland?
So, you know, I think the museum is doing more than telling a historical story. I think we provide an experience that creates memories. And the question is that the end of the story? And for many years, we've treated it as kind of a subtotal. You go from people who are curious, provide them with an experience, and they leave with memories. We've recently started on an initiative to talk about turning memories into action. And that's our form of engagement. We're launching a partnership with the Jewish Volunteer Connection to connect our exhibits and their themes with the ways in which people can contribute to the community. So, for example, with Fashion Statement, having people volunteer by donating clothing to a shelter or by participating in the Dress for Success programs that are around the city. And then the idea is that after a certain number of volunteer hours, you get free admission to the museum. Hmm. So the concept here is to link social action to the memories that you leave the museum with.
That's terrific. And of course, this has also been an animating force in your work, Rebecca, because in addition to any of the exhibitions that you've had over the last 25 years, right? Mm-hmm. You've got speakers, you've got events, you've got things that are related in some way to the exhibition that you have. Because your exhibitions, we should make sure folks remember, are generally put up for a year at a time. You change them in the fall,
correct,
and then they go for a year, and then you have another theme, and you have mm-hmm. art around. Now, this one that we're talking about with Esther and the one family, that's going to be a sort of special occasion. That's going to be up for even longer than a year. But this, it is incumbent upon you, it seems to me. Your whole approach has been to link the artistic creativity of these people with what's going on in the universe as we know it.
That's correct. The themes, I felt like in founding the museum, that it was too late just to be about things, even gorgeous things or expensive things or cool, hip things, that it was important to throw out the challenge of a communal dialogue that would be meaningful. So we have believed as our cornerstone that creative acts of social justice is life's highest performance art, because one has to be fiercely creative to make even a little bits of substantive change. So that's, if you see our glittering walls, they go round, they work as a work of art. They go from, you know, dawn to dusk with a three-story Aurora Borealis. But then you find out, oh, that's the largest apprenticeship program ever undertaken in mosaics with incarcerated and at-risk youth in the whole country. And then you see that there are planets, and that's the way they signed their names, and that they earned lifetime membership at the museum through that. And it's named after Leroy, that the youth, Shining Wall, Shining Youth, Leroy mm-hmm. Hofburger.
Leroy Hofburger, yeah. Who was one of the animating philanthropists who helped AVAM get it started.
Absolutely.
But, of course, every inch of AVAM is an experience. I mean, you go into the bathroom, and our dear friend Bob Benson has stuff, shiny stuff and mirror things, that he does so beautifully in the lavatories, for God's sake. So the experience of being in the building really does matter. So the things are important, but they're just not perhaps the centerpiece.
Well, because it makes you in a dialogue. If you make someone laugh, they call laughter a vacation, really. So because we deal with such incredibly heavy themes, if you look at our history, we always have the humor to choreograph in a little bit of a breath. So when you're sitting on the toity, we're still thinking of you.
So we have a ping from Karen on Facebook, the exhibit entitled Esther and the Dream of One Loving Human Family. That's the one at AVAM. She says it was amazing, moving, sad, and breathtaking. Everything art can and should be. I look forward to returning to this museum. There's too much to see and contemplate in just one visit. My only suggestion is to open the cafe or eating space again so that you can have visitors take their time and wander. You do have a restaurant there, but currently no one's running
a
restaurant.
We're in between.
Yeah, you're in between. So you're looking for a new owner?
Person? Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're zeroing in and excited about that.
And Marvin Pinkert, just as an aside, one of my favorite memories of going to the Jewish Museum of Maryland, I was down there one day, I think interviewing you, sort of late in the morning, around 10:30, 11 o'clock.
And you went over to the deli.
And I went to Atman's when I was finished, probably around 11:30. I went over to Atman's, and I walked in, and for the first time in my life, because I'm a frequent visitor to Atman's, there wasn't any line because it was early enough. It was just like maybe like 11:40 or something. I walked, and there was no line. And I walked in, and the lady behind the counter said, "Honey, it must be your birthday because there's no line, and I'm ready to take your order." I said, "It isn't my birthday, but it feels like Christmas, my birthday, and the 4th of July all wrapped up in one." Oh, my God. But that is
the full Jonestown experience.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And you are affiliated with, I mean, the whole notion of the Jewish Museum came around this very historic synagogue, the Lloyd Street Synagogue, which is right next door to your main building. Tell folks about that, the significance of that historic building.
Well, in 1845, the Jewish community, which had been in the city for decades, finally had the financial resources and the legal ability based on the law that nullified a section of the Constitution that said Jews could not sign contracts that were with the state. They couldn't become a nonprofit organization. They finally had the ability to form a synagogue of their own. And that's how the Lloyd Street Synagogue, originally the congregation there was named Nichle Israel, and then it changed its name to Baltimore Hebrew. And Baltimore Hebrew congregation still exists, so they do not.
They have moved several times since then.
It is just a wonderful building. The synagogue was restored to be more or less as it was in 1860 because the building expanded in 1860, so they couldn't take it back to 1845. And then the lower level is really a history of the life of the synagogue, which was not only Baltimore Hebrew congregation, it was St. John the Baptist Catholic Church. It was Shomrei Mishmeres HaKodesh Synagogue, an Orthodox synagogue. So it has a really wonderful history.
from an Orthodox synagogue, from a Catholic church to an Orthodox synagogue.
Yes.
That's what I call a flexible building. My God, that's fantastic. Rebecca, certainly when the museum opened, and I think you and I have talked about this before when you've been on the show on previous occasions, the term outsider art was the thing that people attached to the museum, which you very purposely called the visionary art museum. Is outsider art a term that's still proper and correct as a descriptive? Is there a term that's replacing it to talk about the kind of artists whose work you are exhibiting?
There is, of course, the big outsider art fair in New York run by Friend, et cetera. I never liked the term because then there were all these boring debates on once you show their art, are they no longer outsiders? Are they now
outside
insiders?
Of what?
Yeah, you know. And I thought, no, let's not make labels like that. The visionary experience is that we all dream, and it's a unifying thought to look within. What we do is we say, you know, we're looking for people who are self-taught. And we don't say if you have a month of art school, you're damaged goods, but almost. We're looking at intuitive genius, which is what actually I think is the evolutionary force in all invention, be it science or medicine. I mean, look at the contributions Elon Musk made to the world of automobiles, not being from that world whatsoever. You sometimes need that distance to see something everybody else has missed. All the people who are working, you know, in sync. And so the outsider in that sense often, if you want to read a great version of outsider, read the book written when Colin Wilson was 19 years old called The Outsider, and he was compared to Yeats. And that's actually where the term came about.
Outsider.
And
art.
That is a marvelous book.
Yeah, of course, this whole notion that you can only be good at one thing.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, look at Leonardo.
Right.
I mean, gosh, I mean, he was a great artist and but also a scientist and a thinker.
Engineer, inventor.
I mean, so, you know, it's Charles Ives, you know, was an insurance salesman. He was one of the most successful insurance executives in New York City for years. And he was also this, you know, wackadoodle composer whose music was, you know, very revolutionary at the time, not so revolutionary now. But Marvin Pinker, the whole notion of what can be art too. The Jewish Museum seems to blow that up time and again. I remember a wonderful exhibition you had about memorabilia from Paul Simon, the great singer-songwriter, and just being in the presence of, you know, that scrap of paper where he writes the phrase "Hello, darkness, my old friend," or whatever it was, you know, the to see these things. It was fun, but it doesn't have to be paintings and sculptures. And
no, our next exhibit is Scrapyard. That's coming in October, and you wouldn't think of Scrapyard as having a place in a museum, but it does, because it not only is it a history of the families who developed the scrap businesses in the United States, but it's also a history of the way in which we've been depending on the fact that not everything gets thrown away, and that our society can't live in a world where everything would be thrown away.
That's fascinating. Yeah, and are the things going to be pretty to look at? Does it matter that they're pretty, that they're beautiful?
Not for me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think one of the most powerful things we have in the city is the memorial to the 9/11 victims from Maryland. It's just in front of the World Trade Center, which is a scrap, a gigantic piece of steel that's all mangled up from the building. Mm-hmm. And the names of the people from Maryland who were killed on that day are there. I go running in the harbor every morning, or many mornings, and I pass it every morning and close my eyes and say a little prayer. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a beautiful, it is in that, you know, beauty is a very fungible
thing. And I often think that the reason I find myself in the history museum business as opposed to the art museum business is the encounter with my father, who was in the scrap business, when we went up to see the Picasso statue, and he said, "Do you know how much that's worth? Per pound?"
Per pound, right. Right. Fantastic. Well, it's a delight to see you both, and these exhibitions sound terrific, and I can't wait to come down and check them both out. So thank you so much, and have a wonderful weekend. Appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Thank you, Tom.
Marvin Pinkert is the executive director of the Jewish Museum of Maryland. Rebecca Hofberger is the founder and director of the American Visionary Art Museum. Both museums, of course, are here in Baltimore. The exhibit Stitching History from the Holocaust continues at the Jewish Museum until the 4th of August, and the companion exhibit, Fashion Statement, runs through the 15th of September. And at the American Visionary Art Museum, Esther and the Dream of One Loving Human Family runs through early 2024. So plenty of time to see it. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, the cabaret legend Steve Ross joins me. He'll be performing at Germano's this weekend. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.